This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. إِنَّ رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خلق السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات بأمره ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية إنه لا يحب المعتدين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines this hour. Iran's president repeats calls for guarantees from the U.S. to revive the nuclear deal as he leaves Tehran for New York to take part in the U.N. General Assembly meeting. The U.S. Central Command says the military's Green Village base in northeast Syria has come under a rocket attack. Also, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterates his anti-China rhetoric, pledging American forces would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion. Thank you for joining us. Iran's president says he will use his visit to the U.S. for the U.N. General Assembly to openly defend the rights of the nation and highlight acts of oppression against it. Ebrahim Raisi further stressed that no meetings with U.S. officials will take place during the visit. This is the first time Raisi will be attending the annual U.N. gathering. Earlier this week, he told CBS News Network that Iran cannot trust the U.S. with what he called meaningless promises on the nuclear deal. Raisi said Iran is serious about reviving the 2015 agreement. He noted, however, that this will hinge on Washington offering relevant guarantees not to follow suit on former U.S. President Donald Trump to withdraw from the accord. A U.S. military base in Syria has come under rocket attack hours after unconfirmed reports of a similar strike on another installation housing American forces. The U.S. Central Command says it's investigating the latest attack that hit the Green Village base in the northeast. It claims the rockets failed to hit any U.S. forces or equipment. An attack on the same base last month injured one U.S. military personnel. The U.S. military has refused to withdraw from Syria even after the country won the war against Daesh Takfiri terrorists. Washington now deploys around 900 troopers in an oil-rich area in eastern Syria. Palestinian schools in occupied Al-Quds will observe a day-long strike on Monday in protest against Israel's attempts to impose distorted textbooks. The Palestinian National and Islamic Forces, a coalition of political factions, has called for the strike. It says the walkout is aimed at reaffirming the right of the Palestinian children to be taught their own curriculum, not the distorted one. The group also called on international institutions to press the regime not to interfere in the affairs of the Palestinian schools. On Saturday, parents and students held protests in several neighborhoods against Israel's attempts to prevent schools from teaching the official Palestinian textbooks. They decried Israel's disregard of their rights and chanted a slogan such as "No to the distorted curriculum" and "No to Judaizing education." The Palestinians say the regime is trying to deny students their right to learn their own history and culture. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is no longer expected to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. A British Foreign Office source said the change in plans was made by Saudi Arabia without mentioning any reason. The British government faced a barrage of criticism for inviting the Saudi Crown Prince to attend the Queen's funeral. The criticism mainly centered around bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His fiancée has called for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrived in London. A number of rights campaigners also cited excessive domestic repression and Saudi Arabia's deadly war against Yemen. They said the occasion would give bin Salman another chance to whitewash his human rights records. According to sources, another Saudi prince will represent the kingdom at the funeral. Earlier, we spoke to our London correspondent, Amina Taylor. She doesn't rule out the Saudi crown prince showing up for the queen's funeral, despite reports to the contrary.
You know, for me, this is a very, what do they say? It kind of smells like three-day-old fish, this particular decision, because just earlier on Press TV, we were discussing this very issue about just how horrible the optics were for a man who, inside his very own cabal, would have ordered the brutal execution of a dissident journalist inside the Saudi consulate in another country. So let's just look at the audacity of that, just as for starters. So whomever, wherever this decision came from, whether or not the palace could see that the optics were not good and perhaps had a word, perhaps MBS himself would have seen that there were just too many people who now knew where he was going to be, what that meant in terms of the focus being on the most appalling aspects of his regime, or even the British government, who might have had a word to say, listen, we'd love you to come, but politically it's a rough time right now. Why don't you just send someone in? Or this is a big smokescreen, and the man will fly in on his private jet, and we'll see him on Monday, sitting front and center, and then he'll fly off. Because these things are about PR, catching your opponents off guard, trying to upset just how people think things might be happening, and then spring in a fast one. So, Kaveh, I personally would not be surprised if tomorrow we saw him show up, because this is just, it's curious. It's a curious decision at this point.
The UK's Prime Minister is under pressure over an economic crisis exacerbated by soaring energy prices as warnings are issued of mass bankruptcies across the country. Liz Truss has unveiled a sweeping package of support for Britons facing soaring energy bills, but much of its detail has remained unpublished. Now, media reports say leading UK business organizations are warning of dire consequences if they continue to be left in limbo over the level of government support. They ask government ministers to show clarity on what help the government could offer them with their energy bills. Experts say many businesses have seen their energy costs skyrocket by 300% compared with last year, putting their future at risk. That's as inflation has hit heights not seen for 30 years, while the pound has sunk to a 37-year low. The U.S. president has reiterated Washington's support for Taiwan despite repeated warnings from China not to interfere in the island's affairs. Joe Biden made the remark while responding to a question during an interview with a U.S. broadcaster.
So unlike Ukraine, to be clear, sir, U.S. forces, U.S. men and women, would defend Taiwan in the event of a Chinese invasion.
Yes.
Biden also talked about the One China policy, saying that the U.S. is not encouraging Taiwan's independence. Biden, however, said American forces would defend the island in case of what he called an unprecedented attack. His comments come amid heightened tensions with China. The two big economies have been on the collision course ever since a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other American politicians to Taiwan last month. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has conducted unprecedented military drills around the island in reaction to growing nexus between Washington and Taipei. The Biden administration has also announced more than $1 billion in new arms sales to Taiwan. The United States is heaping up pressure on Russia on all fronts, from economic sanctions to diplomatic restrictions. But the White House has now gone a step further by telling South Africa not to associate with Russia at all. The South African president has hit back, saying it is not for Washington to decide who his country can or cannot do business with. The move may further alienate the U.S. when it comes to Africa as a whole.
On the surface, this is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He has said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain?
When it comes to investment in Africa, China tops the list of foreign countries. A conservative estimate puts Chinese investment at $126 billion from 2001 to 2018. The figure has increased even further since then. Russia comes in at $20 billion per year, while the U.S. invested almost $45 billion in 2020. Washington's incoherent policy towards Africa may be the reason why it has fallen behind.
South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in his neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase, the U.S. losing its superpower status, continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, "We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with."
Now moving on, the U.S. president is claiming that the pandemic is over, even as the coronavirus is killing hundreds of Americans every day.
Mr. President, first Detroit auto show in 3 years.
Yeah.
Is the pandemic over?
The pandemic is over. We still have a problem with COVID. We're still doing a lot of work on it. But the pandemic is over. If you notice, no one's wearing masks. Everybody seems to be in pretty good shape. And so I think it's changing, and I think this is a perfect example of it.
The comments come as Biden himself has contracted the coronavirus twice over the past months. He has also asked the Congress for over $22 billion in funding to tackle a potential new wave of the pandemic in the autumn. The U.S. is already reeling from the virus, with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention putting the current daily death toll at around 400. Hurricane Fiona has made landfall in Puerto Rico, knocking out all power and threatening to cause catastrophic flooding in the U.S. island territory. Packing winds of 140 kilometers per hour, Fiona is forecast to strengthen further in the next 48 hours as it sweeps across Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic before heading north into the open waters of the Atlantic. Weather forecasts predict life-threatening flash flooding of streams, highways, and streets, as well as urban low-lying and poorly drained areas. Residents have been asked not to leave their homes and go to shelters if they are in areas prone to landslides and flooding. A state of emergency has been declared in Puerto Rico. Speaking of natural disasters, a magnitude 6.8 earthquake has struck the southeastern part of Taiwan, causing casualties and material damage. The island's weather bureau says the epicenter was sparsely populated Taitung County. So far, one person has been confirmed dead, while more than 140 others are injured. It interrupted train services, with reports of six carriages coming off the rails at a station in eastern Taiwan. A convenience store was also toppled, and hundreds of people left stranded on mountainous roads. The earthquake triggered tsunami warnings that were lifted hours later. The quake followed a 6.4 magnitude tremor in the same area on Saturday evening, which caused no casualties. Well, that's a wrap for this hour's World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. Iran's full membership at Shanghai Cooperation Organization shows that U.S. policies toward the Islamic Republic have failed. The four decades-long struggle by the West to isolate Iran became ineffective after Iran's foreign minister signed a memorandum of obligations, a key step in becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in a recent meeting with Secretary General of the SCO, Zhang Ming. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media in order to know more about the developments in this summit. Stay tuned for more. According to Global Times, Chinese President Xi Jinping delivered an important speech on Friday, September 16th, at the summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, in Samarkand, Uzbekistan, emphasizing the need to follow the guidance of the Shanghai spirit as they forge ahead. President Xi pointed out that under new conditions, the SCO, as an important constructive force in international and regional affairs, should keep itself well-positioned in the face of changing international dynamics, ride on the trend of the times, strengthen solidarity and cooperation, and build a closer SCO community with a shared future. The speech received an enthusiastic reaction and resonance at the scene of the meeting, becoming one of the most closely watched and essential parts of the SCO summit. At the summit, leaders of the SCO member states signed the Samarkand Declaration, expressing their unanimous attitude of ruling out bloc, ideologically charged and confrontational approaches to current international and regional development issues, and reaffirming the importance of promoting cooperation in the development of international relations of a new kind in the spirit of mutual respect, equality, and mutually beneficial cooperation, as well as in building a community with a shared future for mankind. In this process, China's role is evident to all. The Global Development Initiative, GDI, and Global Security Initiative, GSI, put forward by the Chinese leader were a response to the concerns of regional countries and have become an increasingly broad and firm consensus in the international community. In stark contrast to the spirit of the SCO, the US-led West is trying to build a Cold War-style alliance based on ideological criteria, leading to the wave of counter-globalization and confrontational split that the world is now experiencing, Deng Kao, Secretary General of the China Center for SCO Studies, told the Global Times recently. The US-led West is now putting extreme pressure on Russia while not reducing its containment of China, Deng said. The geopolitical stakes are at an unprecedentedly high level. Against this backdrop, the sense of crisis and uncertainty facing the vast majority of developing countries has clearly increased. Countries that have not entered the West's small clique have attached great importance to this visit of President Xi and are clearly and eagerly looking forward to his visit, Deng said. This visit is believed to bring confidence and hope to the world. He said because they saw China's development and are more in agreement with the ideas and propositions put forward by China. At the summit, Iran officially became a full SCO member. Asia Times also reported negotiations to build a new pipeline designed to transport annually 50 billion cubic meters of gas from Russia to China through Mongolia are expected to close soon after the three countries' leaders met in Uzbekistan. Chinese President Xi Jinping, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Mongolian President Ukna Kramsleke held a face-to-face meeting in Samarkand on the sideline of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization SCO Summit. The three leaders agreed to actively move forward on the Mongolian section of the China-Russia natural gas pipeline known as Power of Siberia 2. Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak was quoted as saying by Russia's TASS news agency that the Power of Siberia 2 deal would close in the near future. The progress was made recently the same day when Xi and Putin held a bilateral meeting to discuss economic partnership and geopolitical issues, including Ukraine and Taiwan matters. Also, Al Jazeera English wrote, Iran has signed a memorandum of obligations to become a permanent member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization SCO, a Central Asian security body, the Iranian foreign minister said. Hossein Amir Abdullahian wrote on social media, by signing the document for full membership of the SCO, now Iran has entered a new stage of various economic, commercial, transit and energy cooperation.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, this program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, how the story of Karbala and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, unites the people of the Indian subcontinent. And we will see how India buying oil from Russia may affect the foreign policy and economy of this country.
every year at an event known as the largest annual gathering in the world. Several million people gather together in Iraq for Arba'in, the 40th day of the tragedy of Karbala, when Imam Hussein, the grandson of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam, peace be upon them, was martyred with his companions and family members. Arba'in processions send a message of justice, faith and unity. The commemoration extends beyond any religion and is engaged in by all those who believe in humanity.
Arba'in marks the culmination of the 40-day period of mourning after the tragedy of Karbala, which happened on 10th Muharram in the Islamic calendar. The event marks a heroic battle of good versus evil, justice against injustice, where the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, his 72 companions and family members showed strength and determination against the forces of Yazid, the tyrannical ruler who established his position at the helm by virtue of the sword rather than the word. Yazid ibn Muawiyah's forces brutally and mercilessly slayed the innocent followers of justice after keeping them thirsty for 3 days. This act of heroism attracts millions of people from around the world, even after 1,400 years, to come together and commemorate this event in large processions as a sign of remembrance and protest under the banner of equity and justice against tyranny and oppression. According to Forbes, over 40 million people participated in Arba'in pilgrimage in 2016, and the number keeps growing every year. These people mainly walk the whole 45 miles from the city of Najaf to the city of Karbala, and on their way, the pilgrims are served with not only food, shelter, and water, but are even provided medical services and security.
The War of Karbala, where Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them, who stood up against a tyrannical ruler, Yazid ibn Muawiyah, is believed to transcend all cultural boundaries and be a symbol of universal freedom, compassion, and social justice. The struggle of Imam Hussein and his companions against injustice and their sacrifice in Karbala is not only an example of humanity at its best, but represents a chance for the diverse people of the subcontinent to unite and come together in a struggle for justice.
The people of the subcontinent religiously participate in the holy activities of Muharram, including the Ashura processions. Those who cannot go directly to Karbala participate in local processions, which happen all across the globe on the 10th of Muharram and 40 days after. These huge rallies include hundreds of thousands of people at any one time, and even millions in some instances. In India, although most processions are allowed, some of the main Muharram processions have been banned by the government since 1989. But believers prepare for the ritual every year nonetheless. In Indian-controlled Kashmir, the processions are often attacked by the Indian police, as Kashmiris often use Muharram processions as an inspiration to protest against the oppression perpetrated by the Indian government. In Pakistan, Muslims organize and participate in processions, but the threat of attacks from extremists looms over the faithful. Therefore, the processions are held under tight security. This is because of bomb blasts and suicide attacks that mark Pakistani Shia gatherings every year. And although the attacks have decreased, it is estimated that in Pakistan, over 23,000 Shia Muslims have been killed since 1963. The killings were once so rampant that some researchers describe it as genocide.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sayyid Salman Naghavi. He's an Islamic scholar from Pakistan, currently residing in Rome. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Naghavi. Now, the story of Karbala brings people of diverse faiths together against injustice. Now, how do you think this can unite minorities of India against injustice, seeing that the sacrifice of Imam Hussein and his companions in Karbala is mourned not just by Muslims, but by Hindus and Christians as well?
Yes, in the name of Allah, the Supreme Absolute Being, the message of Muhammad alayhi salam is listen. It has a global appeal because the mission of Imam Hussein was to stand up against injustice and tyranny and corruption. And basically, the underpinning ideology of Imam Hussein's movement was based on the fact that he was fighting for the cause of mankind and for providing it competent and worthy leadership. And therefore, the issue that all of mankind faces today is the imposition of the hegemonic rule of people who are not competent, not worthy. They are deprived of basic moral values and principles, and they want to create a world order in which they are at the head of and at the head of all the affairs of the of mankind, and wherever we have injustice and wherever we have tyranny, where we the Muslims or mankind in general faces oppression at the hands of people who are not worthy of ruling other people. They are not competent. They do not have moral and ideological beliefs which can make them serve mankind for the sake of mankind. We have a problem, and that is why Imam Hussein stood up against that corrupt regime.
Mr. Naghavi, the Arabian processions have been held worldwide on a massive scale, but why is the media coverage so limited or non-existent in some outlets?
Yes, I think that because the global hegemony in the media is of the Zionists, and they do not want us to lay the ground for a movement against that hegemonistic oppression they are perpetrating all over the world. So they would not like us, like the world, to understand that such a movement is growing day by day, every year. You look, the Pakistanis coming from Pakistan, they are increasing every year. The biggest movement of mankind, Pakistanis, subcontinent people, they are becoming a part of it, despite the floods, despite so many problems that the Pakistanis are facing, just because of that. Now, those who are, they are oppressing us, they are perpetrating that tyrannical global hegemony. They don't want people of the world to realize that such an awakening is being created, which may turn against them. They may have issues which I think they need to cover up today. They need to hide this truth, that this may be a ritualistic movement today, but tomorrow it will turn up into a grand revolution against the oppressive regimes and the corrupt regimes of the world. Today, we in Pakistan or in the subcontinent are facing the consequences of global warming. And Pakistan or the subcontinent has a very small impact in that. 1% of the impact is from Pakistan, but it is facing 10% of the consequences, the calamities, the floods. And this is because of the injustice which is taking place in the world. So this movement for Imam Hussein, it may be just a mourning ceremony for Imam Hussein and the Arba'een, but it will change into something global, universal, which has an appeal for the world. Today, even in the West, everyone there knows that 1% of the population is ruling over the 99%. So if they understand that Imam Hussein is calling us.
So, Mr. Naghavi, why is it that the Indian or in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the Indian government meddles in the religious affairs of its Muslim population?
We all know that in Kashmir, the people of Kashmir, the Muslims of Kashmir, whether Shias or the Sunnis, they have been oppressed, they have been deprived of their rights, they want freedom from India, they want to be independent, or they want to have freedom from India. And for expressing that, the outpouring of their feelings can be channelized through the Muharram and the Arba'een movement. And any such movement which provides that ground and facilitates that expression of that political ideology and sentiment will certainly be, again, as we were talking about the media, the Indian occupied Kashmir or the Indian administered Kashmir, they will certainly not allow that to happen, because again, Imam Hussein will provide us the opportunity, he will provide the Kashmiris to channelize their aspirations for the sake of nationhood through Imam Hussein's movement. And that is something which is there for all of mankind. On one hand, we have the Palestinians on the western flank and the eastern flank. We have two oppressed, occupied nations. And till it was a nationalistic movement, we did not have success. They were not successful. Since it became an Islamic movement, and thereby, within the Islamic movement, the movement of Imam Hussein is given a central position, and our feelings and our ideology are channelized through this movement, it will certainly have its results.
Last but not least, sir, are mourners of Imam Hussein in Pakistan allowed to commemorate Imam Hussein's sacrifice freely and safely?
Actually, in Pakistan, the Shia community has been observing Muharram and Safar since the time it became independent from India and before that. As a ritualistic mourning, every year it has been able to carry out this commemoration of Imam Hussein's martyrdom. It has been facilitated by the government, but all through the past decades, we have been facing problems at the hands of those who have been incited against the unity of the Ummah, against the Shias residing in Pakistan, at the hands of the stooges of Takfiris and those who have a Wahhabi ideology to stand up against the Shias. So they have been creating problems for Pakistanis, and they have influence in all the institutions, and they do create problems. They do create issues where, for example, over the last few years, FIRs have been registered against many people who are carrying out these ceremonies. But the problem again here, for example, the movement of the Pakistanis towards Iraq this year has been problematic. And again, the Pakistani authorities have not very much facilitated that. The Iraqi authorities have been providing excuses which cannot be accepted fully.
There you have it, Mr. Sayyid Salman Naghavi, Islamic scholar from Pakistan, currently residing in Rome. Thank you for being on the program, Mr. Naghavi. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Jaigar Malik says, "No caste, no religion, no nationality, no black and white. All are equal here. Yes, this is Karbala, Arbaeen Imam Hussein, the world's largest peaceful gathering." Aditya Menon says, "Not surprising that people say in Kashmir every day is Ashura and every town is Karbala." Michelle says, "Even non-Muslims come to visit Imam Hussein in Arbaeen. Have you thought to yourself why?"
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Russia is one of the most heavily sanctioned countries on earth right now, and Uncle Sam is trying to ensure that no one can help Russia during this time. However, India, which has close ties to the US, is still buying Russian oil at cheap prices.
Under the garb of Ukraine war, the United States and its allies in Europe and Asia quickly moved to impose unprecedented sanctions against the Russian economy. Among the measures they adopted include freezing nearly half of Russia's financial reserves, expelling a number of Russia's largest banks from the SWIFT payment system, and placing an embargo on Russian oil and coal. Not that this has worked, Russia has used sanctions as an opportunity to boost its self-reliance, as the country has offered cheap oil to the world and revenues continue to soar. Russia's current currency reserve surplus swelled to a record high of $167 billion between January and July, more than triple from a year earlier. India and China have been buying Russian crude against the wishes of the U.S. and its allies. To counter this, the U.S. is trying to bring the G7 countries, consisting of the U.K., U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan, on board to cap Russian oil price, in the hope that Russian oil revenues can be restricted.
The G7 nations led by the U.S. are trying to apply a price cap on Russian oil sales, and the European Union urged China and India to join the G7 initiative to apply a cap on Russian oil prices. However, China has not complied and India has remained silent on the matter. The Indian Petroleum Minister Hardeep Singh told CNBC that India has a duty to its consumers and that India will buy from Russia or from wherever else they may wish and choose to do so.
Analysts claim that the reason for global inflation and the fuel crisis in Europe are a result also of the policies of the West against Russia. If the Western imperial powers had not sanctioned Russia, global oil prices would have been stable and fuel prices would have been low. Because of the response of the US and EU to the conflict in Ukraine, Russia has now lowered its fuel prices, which in turn pushed other oil-producing countries to lower their prices to compete with Russia. This has ultimately benefited countries like India, which has used its low-cost Russian crude to give a boost to its economy, surpassing the UK to become the fifth largest economy in the world, only behind US, China, Japan, and Germany. Low oil prices have helped India cope with inflated US dollar and global prices. Thus, Indian foreign reserves have been less affected than it would have been had India not made a deal with the Russian Federation. Speaking at GlobeSec, Indian Foreign Minister S. Jaishankar said India is not sitting on the fence and it is entitled to make its own decisions when it comes to policy, rather than siding with other countries.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Anuradha Mitra Chinoy, adjunct professor at the School of International Relations at Jindal Global University in New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Chinoy. Now, how much do you think the response by the U.S. and its allies to the conflict in Ukraine has affected the world so far?
I think this war is really driven by the U.S. and the allies. Ukraine would not have been able to fight back at all and would have collapsed very fast without the support of the huge amount of weapons, the earlier training, strategic suggestions, the intelligence by the US and their allies. Essentially, what I'm saying is there has been a strong element of a proxy war here. Also, of course, the Ukrainian soldiers have put up a great fight. But this would not have been possible without the support of the US and NATO.
Mr. Chinoy, it's interesting to see what's going on in the world right now. The US and its allies are trying their best to corner Russia, but nothing seems to be working. Now, do you think this new move by the US and its allies to put a cap on Russian oil prices will work?
I don't think so, because just look at the US move on cap on oil prices. Basically, it targets the insurance companies. And the insurance companies have been pressured to say that they will not insure the ships which carry Russian oil. But the Russian oil goes through various ways. Countries like, Russia is calibrating its oil prices accordingly. So They've already negotiated a pretty interesting deal with the Chinese, where they're going to give Russian oil at discounted prices of 50%, but guaranteed till December. So that's one source where Russian oil continues to go regardless of price fluctuations. Similarly, India's getting oil at discounted prices. So I don't know how a cap on prices will impact India. And similarly, several countries of the global south. So then today I just saw that they are sending a shipload even to Greece. So it doesn't look like their efforts, which have not worked so far, will work as far as oil is concerned. The world is oil hungry, especially the developing countries, and also for other Russian commodities. So first, I don't think this is going to really work, and winter is coming. So Europe will have to also rethink, just like Hungary is rethinking, for example, and Bulgaria and some others. But nonetheless, the U.S. wants to have a long war of attrition, of economically decimating Russia. And in the long run, they're going to keep isolating it. So, of course, Russia will, there will be some impacts, negative impacts on Russia, no matter how much they balance with others. They will be isolated from the overall Western economy.
Last but not least, Mrs. Chinoy, in your assessment, have a cheaper Russian oil bill and in general, India-Russia trade ties helped India surpass the UK economy?
To some extent, yes, but the fact is that India does have an industrial and manufacturing base, which has, you know, it's a long history of Indian economy, which has resulted in this. It's not a one-day or a six-month affair. It is how the Indian economic system has been over so many years, you know, a gradual development. Of course, there's a lot of inequality, but there are also reforms which have helped the economic elite gain a great deal. And in that, oil and also manufacturing and defense production and other production, and the fact that several industries which are moving from China, some of which have come to India. India has also been a beneficiary, as have Vietnam and South Korea. So there have been benefits to that extent, and that's helped all of this together.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. Chinoy for being on the program. She is a professor at the School of International Relations. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Martin Jack claims the West's strategy on Ukraine depends on economic sanctions against Russia. Those sanctions aren't working because Russian oil exports to India and China far exceed Western sanctions against Russia. The West still thinks it dominates the world, but China and India prove this is no longer the case. Reuters. India says importing Russian oil part of inflation management. Bloomberg. Russian oil imports now account for 12% of India's total, up from 2% in just a few months.
And that was our episode about Karbala and the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, which unites the people of the Indian subcontinent. And also how India buying oil from Russia affects the foreign policy and economy of this country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
After the death of Queen Elizabeth, the issue of colonialism by the British during long decades came to mind. But what we should consider is that colonialism still exists around us. When social media companies, including Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook silence the users who speak against colonialism, it means colonialism still exists. When the fabricated regime of Israel continues its crimes against innocent Palestinians and the world body is silent, it means colonialism still exists. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned, please. In the aftermath of the announcement of the death of the British Queen Elizabeth, Juju Ann, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, tweeted, "I heard the chief monarch of a thieving, raping, genocide empire is finally dying. May her pain be excruciating." Twitter deleted the tweet, and Carnegie Mellon put out a statement effectively condemning Ann's remarks, each of which are absurd and dubious, as others have noted. But then Anne retweeted a tweet from Eugene Scott, national political reporter at the Washington Post. "Real question for the now is not the appropriate time to talk about the negative impact of colonialism, crowd. When is the appropriate time to talk about the negative impact of colonialism? The answer to Scott's question, when is the appropriate time to talk about the negative impact of colonialism, is every day. You're swimming in it." "9/11 was a good occasion to talk about the negative impacts of colonialism, how the US, British and French governments caught up the Mideast, leading to the rise of a colonial Israel and oppressive monarchies, the massive propaganda campaign that effectively began 20 years ago to invade Iraq should now be the focus of sustained attention if we had a cultural and media environment wanting to finally come to terms with its imperialist mindset, waging wars of aggression, occupying entire countries, and employing systematic torture for those ends in the 21st century.